Rom, WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, December 19th. Flooded homeowners in Sarasota have one less reason for anxiety, it seems. Crews are at work as Sarasota County has finally begun dredging Philippi Creek. A little more than a year ago, the shallow waterway flooded hundreds of homes in the Pinecraft and Southgate neighborhoods after the record rainfall brought by Tropical Storm Debbie. This morning, Ben Quartermain, the head of the county's newly created stormwater department, appeared at a press conference in the Southgate neighborhood to explain technical details. Phase one of the dredging project covers 7 miles from the creek's mouth to South Beneva Road. It will eliminate 7 of 11 large sediment high spots from Tuttle Avenue to Beneva. Phase one is expected to take 6 months, possibly to be finished in time for the 2026 hurricane season. Starbucks baristas in Florida continue to be part of a national month-long strike. Starbucks Workers United, the union formed 4 years ago, went to strike over what they see as unfair labor practices. A Starbucks in downtown Clearwater at 433 Cleveland Street is on strike. Supporting teachers, union members, and Teamsters have joined the Starbucks picket line in downtown, and picketing is planned for today, Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday, Christmas Eve. The striking baristas are also asking patrons to sign a no contract, no coffee pledge. Byron Donalds is the clear frontrunner among Republicans competing in the race for governor, ahead more than 27% of the nearest competitor. He's also the overall leader in fundraising, with $40 million in his campaign treasure chest, more than twice as much any Republican in the state has raised for a primary contest. The businessman from Naples has garnered the endorsement of Donald Trump. In the Democratic camp, David Jolly, a formerly Republican congressman, is now competing with Jerry Demings, the current mayor of Orange County and a former sheriff. Both Donalds and Demings are black, which could mean Florida could get its first black governor in 2026. And finally, free rides on Florida turnpikes. Governor Ron DeSantis is floating the idea of ending roadway tolls for all Florida residents. At a cabinet meeting Wednesday, the outgoing governor, who may run for president again, said that tourists could cover the cost to give residents a break. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, December 19th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Just when it seemed the Orange Menace of Palm Beach could not be more hypocritical or narcissistic, his response to the tragic murder of Rob and Michelle Reiner, allegedly by their son, has reset that bar. In a time when any perceived negative mention of the murdered right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, no matter how true, could lose someone their job, Trump has blamed Reiner himself for his demise, for so irritating people with his so-called Trump derangement syndrome. I must agree that Trump derangement syndrome is real, but only one person truly suffers from it, the deranged president himself. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my interview with Elise Bennett, the Florida and Caribbean Director for the Center of Biological Diversity, who explains why some proposed changes to the way the Endangered Species Act spells almost certain doom for plants and animals on the verge of extinction, and why that will be a disaster for humans. But first, listen to how the affordability of energy is diminishing, and that is not a Democratic hoax. The amount of money Americans are paying for their energy bills has increased since President Donald Trump took office earlier this year, according to a new report. In the U.S., electric bills have increased 13% in 2025, according to Climate Power, a climate advocacy organization whose national advisory board features prominent Democratic politicians and activists. Climate Power analyzed data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The report pointed to the massive spending bill Trump signed in July, which it claims is driving up utility costs and destroying jobs by removing cheaper, cleaner energy sources from the grid, all the while funding new tax breaks for oil and gas industries. Projects that were canceled or delayed since Trump's election have led to a loss of 24,958 megawatts of planned energy generation, which could have powered more than 13.1 million homes, according to the report. Prices are expected to spike even further, especially as rising energy demands are driven by data centers and extreme heat, the study said. In the electricity sector, demand is currently outpacing growth by a lot, said David Spence, a professor of energy law and regulation at the University of Texas. He agreed that data centers are partly to blame, in addition to other energy-intensive technologies such as Bitcoin mining and electric vehicles. Americans are also in debt due to higher energy costs, said Mike Pierce, an attorney and executive director of Project Borrowers. As of November, Texas had the highest number of residents in utility debt, with more than 943,000 households with overdue balances, according to research by Project Borrowers. Energy affordability and what to do about it is currently a topic that everybody on Capitol Hill wants to talk about and is fixated on. Daniel Brissett, president of the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, told ABC News. When asked for comment on the Climate Power Report, a White House spokesperson told ABC News, "Fixing the energy crisis Joe Biden created has been a priority for President Trump since day one. Joe Biden's green energy policy sent electricity prices soaring for more than 30% over 40 years in blue states that refused to adopt President Trump's energy dominance agenda continue to have sky-high energy prices." Trump has denounced wind energy since his first term, claiming in 2019 that the noise from wind turbines caused cancer, and stating in May 2024 that turbines kill whales. There are no case series, clinical studies, or epidemiological studies reliably documenting a link between wind turbine exposure and cancer. And according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, there are no known links between large whale deaths and ongoing offshore wind activities. In August, the Environmental Protection Agency terminated Solar for All, a $7 billion Biden-era grant program intended to help pay for resident solar projects. Environmental groups condemned the cut, warning that lowering energy bills, especially in low-income households, would be more difficult as a result. Trump also spent a considerable amount of his address to the United Nations General Assembly in September disparaging renewable energy resources, claiming that renewable energy sources don't work and are too expensive. What's happening behind the scenes is the Trump administration is doing everything it can to quash clean energy, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, said during a media briefing. Clean energy is almost always low cost. more than 165,000 jobs in the clean energy sector have been lost or stalled as a result of Trump's policies, according to the Climate Power Report. No big surprise here. The numbers are in and show fewer Canadians are coming to Florida. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said he will be abstaining from his regular winter trip to Florida and noted that many other Canadians are engaged in the snowbird boycott that is hurting the state's economy as well as the popularity of President Donald Trump. They're hurting down there right now. They're hurting on all fronts. Their economy especially, Ford said during a press conference this week. President Trump has the lowest approval ratings of any president in their first year, and God knows, probably 100 years. So this is taking effect. The boycott of U.S. products and travel sparked by Trump's tariffs, as well as his repeated references to the nation as the 51st state, has already had notable effect on tourist figures and led to significant impacts in many U.S. businesses, including alcohol companies whose products remain off the shelves in several Canadian provinces. Ford, conservative politician who has taken a hard-line stance against many of Trump's economic policies and clashed with the U.S. president as a result, made the comments during a conference where he unveiled a multi-billion-dollar plan to turn Niagara Falls, which sits on the border of Ontario and New York, into a world-class tourist destination. Responding to a reporter's question about the organic boycott of U.S.-bound tourism from Canada, Ford said this winter would be his first, not visiting the Sunshine State, but encouraged other Canadians to decide for themselves. That's my personal choice. Maybe some families have gone to Florida their whole lives. Go to Florida. That's great, he said. But I encourage people to stay here and support local tourism. You can't let one tyrant change your life. Florida typically sees a seasonal surge in snowbird tourism. North American residents fleeing cold winters by journeying to the U.S. Sun Belt or other warmer locales, but figures are dropping as tensions between the two countries have risen in 2025. According to the most recent data from Florida State Tourism Board, visitor numbers from Canada plummeted 20% year over year in the 3 months which ended June 30th, following a 17% decline in the first quarter. A recent survey from Snowbird Advisory, which polled 4,000 of its members, typically retirees or seasonal travelers, found that 70% planned to spend their winter in the U.S. compared to 82% of respondents last year. Many travelers, it noted, were now opting instead for international destinations like Mexico or Costa Rica or the warmer European countries. Beyond the loss of revenue for tourism-focused businesses in places like Florida, the boycott and the broader rise in anti-U.S. feelings among Canadians also appears to be taking a toll on the state's housing market. An analysis by Realtor.com found that Florida metros accounted for 6 out of the 10 whose homes values were falling fastest in the U.S. due to a confluence of factors impacting buyer demand in the state. Neil Phelan, a real estate agent operating in the west coast of Florida, told Newsweek that much of this declining demand was due to Canadians putting their homes up for sale due to the current environment between Canada and the U.S. Phelan said Canadians account for between 15 to 20% of his buyers and that their exit was proving a significant loss in the purchasing market. Aside from Florida, a new report from U.S. Congress Joint Economic Committee revealed that declining Canadian tourism is impacting American businesses across every state along the U.S.-Canadian border. From January to October 2025, the number of passenger vehicles crossing the U.S.-Canada border declined by nearly 20% compared to the same period of time in 2024, with some states seeing declines as large as 27%, the report read, citing figures from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Moderate House Republicans are decrying the Speaker's reluctance to hold a vote on ACA subsidies. House GOP moderates are threatening to cut a deal with Democrats after Speaker Mike Johnson ruled out giving them a vote on extending expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies. House moderates, some in tough re-election fights, feel they need to do something on the subsidies, but they're nowhere close to convincing their leadership. The House was set to vote this week on consensus GOP health care package, but an ACA fix is not likely to be among what passes. It's idiotic. It's political malpractice. Rep. Mike Lawler, Republican from North Carolina, told reporters of Johnson refusing to give them an ACA extension vote. Lawler, along with Reps. Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican from Pennsylvania, and Kevin Kiley, Republican from California, didn't rule out signing on to House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries' discharge petition, which would force a vote on a clean 3-year extension of the subsidies, though both acknowledged that plan would likely die in the Senate. Rep. Jen Kiggins has ruled out signing on for the moment, a source familiar with her plans told Axios. There are 3 discharge petitions aimed at forcing a vote to extend the ACA subsidies, a direct circumvention of GOP leadership. 2 of them, one led by Fitzpatrick and the other by Kiggins and Rep. Josh Gothheimer, already have substantial number of Republican signatures. The 3rd petition, led by Jeffries, would need only 4 GOP signatures to force a vote, giving moderates enormous leverage. Johnson told reporters that they tried to find a pressure release valve for the members who wanted to vote on extending the subsidies, but in the end, there was not an agreement. The issue centers around demands that the amendment include offsets, an idea that moderates feared would water down the bill. "It's not me that's not giving the vote," the speaker added, arguing that moderates declined to include pay-fors. Kiggins plans to try to offer her ACA extension bill that would include a pay-for as an amendment to the GOP leadership plan, a source familiar with the matter told Axios. It's not clear whether they get that through the Rules Committee. House Democratic leadership is hopeful that if they refuse to budge on their 3-year extension red line, Republicans will eventually defect and sign on to Jeffries' discharge petition, 2 senior House Democrats told Axios. A House Democrat who has spoken with the Republican moderates, however, expressed skepticism that their threats to sign Jeffries' petition are anything more than performative. The Gothheimer discharge petition, this lawmaker said, is the backstop for that scenario. Several progressives in interviews with Axios did not rule out supporting an extension shorter than 3 years if it had Jeffries' support. "I'm deferring to the leadership to assess the situation," said Rep. Pramila Jayapal from Washington. "I see this as a failure of leadership on both sides. I think it's fallen upon, you know, us as members to try to navigate this process and try to use what leverage points and whatever levers we have to get a vote to get a policy enacted," Kiley said. "I think this is why people are so frustrated with Congress and why Congress has a 15% approval rating?" Republican Senator Ron Johnson has promoted a book proposing bleach as a cure for autism. I guess that explains his support for the crackpot RFK Jr. At a time when Americans' trust in public health agencies is waning, Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, is under fire for promoting a book peddling an unfounded medical theory that bleaching can treat autism and other diseases. Johnson has a quote featured on the jacket of The War on Chlorine Dioxide, a book co-authored by Dr. Pierre Corey, a controversial physician and pulmonary specialist who gained national attention during the COVID-19 pandemic for advocating off-label use of an ineffective wonder drug treatment. The American Board of Internal Medicine revoked Corey's certification in 2024, which blocks him from practicing medicine at large hospitals and academic institutions. He still has a medical license, however. But that hasn't prevented Johnson, who has been lambasted for spreading misinformation in the past, from supporting the discredited doctor's claims that chlorine dioxide, a chemical used for disinfecting and bleaching, can help treat autism, COVID, cancer, and a host of other ailments. In the blurb on the cover, the three-term senator called Corey's book a gripping tale of corruption and courage that will open eyes and promote serious questions. In a statement to ProPublica, which first reported the book, quote, Johnson confirmed he authorized the statement. Johnson has regularly cast doubt on the usefulness of vaccines, telling reporters earlier this year that many childhood illnesses, such as the measles, can be eradicated through better hygiene and sanitation instead. During the pandemic, he called Corey, who advocated that Americans take ivermectin, an anti-parasite medicine, to treat COVID-19, as an expert witness during at least two 2020 Senate hearings. We are facing a dangerous barrage of misinformation that ignores evidence and dismisses the scientific process, undermining our national response and belief in science, a group of medical and scientific experts said in response to the testimony at the time. Johnson's support for the books, for its book and its author, come at a time when there are significant clashes over public health in the United States, particularly the leadership of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently recast the vaccine safety section of its website to question the long-held stance that vaccines do not cause autism, countering decades of scientific evidence showing them to be safe. Now there is evidence that trust in federal health agencies such as the CDC is declining since the Trump administration returned to power. An Ipsos survey released in October found that 54% of respondents trust the agency, down from 60% in June and 66% in December of 2024. Same goes for the Food and Drug Administration, which the poll shows dropped from 60% of respondents saying they had trust in it last December to 52% currently. Apparently, Musk is back on board with the GOP. Elon Musk has begun funding GOP's House and Senate campaigns for the 2026 midterms, an indication his relationship with President Trump has thawed since their messy breakup earlier this year. Musk threatened to launch a third party and support challengers to Republican incumbents during his dispute with Trump, and he is now firmly back in the GOP's camp. The tech billionaire recently cut big checks to help Republicans win congressional races next year and indicated that he'll give more through the 2026 cycle, two sources with knowledge of the situation told Axios. Musk's donation amounts won't be disclosed publicly until campaign finance reports are released next month, but his support could be a huge boost for Trump's Republicans next year as they try to stop Democrats from reclaiming power in Congress, particularly the House. Musk is the world's richest person, was the biggest donor in the 2024 campaign, giving a mind-boggling $291.5 million, the vast majority to boost Trump's reelection effort. Musk's latest donations came after he had dinner last month with Vice President Vance, White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, and Taylor Bodewich, a former White House Deputy Chief of Staff who's still wired into the administration. Vance, who's close to Musk, helped organize the dinner at the Vice President's residence at the Naval Observatory. Jared Birchall, a low-profile Musk lieutenant who plays a key role in managing Musk's political giving, was also present. After the 2024 election, Trump invited Musk into the administration to oversee the federal cost-cutting effort Musk dubbed the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. The two grew close in the early days of Musk's second term, and Musk spent some nights at the White House. But after Musk departed the administration in May, he and Trump had a bitter falling out. Musk was angered by, among other things, Trump's decision to withdraw the nomination of Musk ally Jared Isaacman to lead NASA. Musk called Trump's Big Beautiful Bill a disgusting abomination because of its high costs, highlighted Trump's ties to the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, and threatened to form what he called the American Party to run his favorite candidates for Congress. Trump called Musk crazy and said he was disappointed in him. Musk later acknowledged regret over some of his remarks about Trump, and the two spoke at a memorial service for conservative activist Charlie Kirk in September. Now Trump and Musk allies say they're near certain Musk won't follow through on his threat to oust Republicans. Instead, they say he's positioning himself as a traditional Republican donor who sends big checks to the party's campaign arms and super PACs. Republicans' representatives for Trump and Musk declined to comment, as did a spokespeople for the pro-GOP House and Senate super PACs. Trump and Musk speak occasionally, and Musk attended a White House dinner that Trump held last month for Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Trump has moved on from his fight with Musk, sources familiar with his thinking say. His relationship with Musk has improved, the sources say, but the pair will never be as close as they once were. According to a recent report, the number of biologists at Fish and Wildlife Service has been cut. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lost 18% of its staff under the Trump administration, dropping from 9,957 to 8,179 nationwide between 2024 and the end of May. The massive reduction in biologists and other staffers was discovered in data obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request by the Center for Biological Diversity. The staff losses are the result of DOGE-driven cuts, retirement and resignation incentives, and a hiring freeze that was just lifted, but with the caveat that any new hire would have come with cuts of four other positions. While some resignations preceded Trump's inauguration, such losses would normally have been replaced. Monarch butterflies, hellbender salamanders, and so many more plants and animals are staring down the barrel of extinction, while the Trump administration slashes staff dedicated to preserving America's struggling wildlife, said Noah Greenwald, endangered species co-director at the center. This is an agency that needs more resources to help endangered species and the places they live, not fewer, but by pushing biologists and other wildlife experts out of the public service, Trump is inflicting enormous harm on some of America's most beloved creatures. The result could be extinction. According to the data, nearly 900 of the 2,330 staff that were on the roster in 2024 but not 2025 are biologists. Fewer biologists means the service has significantly less staff tracking the status of plants and animals or working to restore or manage habitats to help wildlife. Many of the staff who left the agency were senior level, and in some cases likely responded to the administration's early retirement offer. For example, Hawaii, which is often referred to as the extinction capital of the world, lost 10 senior-level scientists and managers. Florida lost 20 senior-level scientists and managers. California lost 40, and Oregon and Washington combined lost 51. Losing staff is bad enough, but losing senior experts with the experience and knowledge needed to save endangered species is devastating, said Greenwald. The Trump administration attacks on our environmental law and the agencies that carry them out is beyond reckless. These staff cuts are completely irresponsible in the midst of our world's twin climate and extinction crises. According to the documents provided to the court in a lawsuit brought by the government employee unions and others, the administration plans to eliminate another 143 positions at the service, but it is blocked from doing so until January 30th by the agreement to reopen the government. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my conversation with Elise Bennett from the Center for Biological Diversity, who will elaborate on that last story.
I'm Lou Lorini, and I'm happy to welcome Elise Bennett, who is the Florida and Caribbean Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, who believes that the welfare of human beings is deeply linked to nature, to the existence in our world of a vast diversity of wild animals and plants. Thanks for coming on the show, Elise. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Great. You know, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to be with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Sure. Well, I'm a born and raised Floridian. I spent many of my younger years tromping around swamps and swimming in lakes and visiting our beautiful beaches and just really fell in love with my home. And growing up here also means seeing many of those beautiful places I loved disappear to strip malls and industrial development, and that really drove me to do the work of trying to protect what makes our state so special.
Yeah. Well, these days, you know, we do have, I don't know, a White House that's doing a bunch of, I don't know, in my opinion, crazy things, and You know, among them, they've proposed several changes to the Endangered Species Act that is up your alley, and that if they're adopted, that weaken or limit how endangered species can be protected. You know, let's start with one. You know, changes to Section 4. You know, what is it, and what will that do?
Yeah, well, I like to start with the big picture, and then Section 4 is a great place to start. But the Endangered Species Act itself is actually an incredibly well-designed, basically an emergency room for species that are facing extinction. And the idea is that we prevent them from blinking out, and then we lead them toward recovery to a point where they no longer need protection under the Act. That's the goal and the purpose. And it's been incredibly effective. It's protected 99% of species that are listed under the Act. It's prevented their extinction, and it's sent hundreds of species on the road to recovery and has recovered many iconic species that we all know and love today, from the bald eagle to the American alligator. And so, you know, it's a really tried and true system to protect the fabric of life that we all depend on for our own well-being and happiness. And that protection really starts with Section 4 that you mentioned, which is the provision that tells our wildlife agencies to list species as endangered or threatened. And once they're listed, they receive a whole host of protections. And so that listing process under the statute says that species should be protected if they're in danger of extinction or likely to become endangered in the foreseeable future. And it tasks the wildlife agencies with looking at the best available science about the species status and their threats, which includes everything from habitat destruction to pollution, to disease, to just weak regulatory mechanisms that fail to protect them at the state level and the local level. And these new regulations would really undercut that listing process. And the main way that it attempts to do that is by allowing for economic and other considerations, like political considerations, to be considered when a species is being listed. And not only is that contrary to the purpose of the Endangered Species Act, it's also directly contrary to the statute, which says that these decisions need to be made based solely on the best available science about the species.
Yeah, like I guess you know, a good example of that would have been, I recall, and I'm kind of winging it here, you know, there was a controversy over the spotted owl in California, and I believe it stopped some construction because it endangered the habitat of the spotted owl. And I guess under the new, if this passes the new regulations, you know, that wouldn't be allowed because it was going to cost somebody money.
Right. I mean, these regs are really a handout to polluters, developers, and industries that are driving these species towards extinction. And that's ultimately destroying Americans' collective natural heritage and our interest and love of these creatures. And so the law was meant to temper that. And Congress actually explicitly said when they passed the law that they were observing that species were being driven towards extinction by economic growth that was untempered by adequate concern and conservation. So that was the purpose of this law, to be a counterbalance and to make sure we were recognizing and protecting the value of biodiversity and each individual creature that shares this earth with us. These regulations do exactly the opposite, right? They tip the scales in favor of these industries that are causing harm to our biodiversity.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, any effort to, you know, protect an endangered species, you know, that, as I said before, might cost somebody some money, you know, particularly, you know, a developer or a polluter or whatever, you know, means that, you know, they can't be protected, that it's like, hey, you're kind of on your own animal or plant.
You know, absolutely.
Build this, yeah. Yeah.
And it's incredibly short-sighted. I mean, you know, the other thing that this new regulation would do is it would change the way the agency looks at what the foreseeable future means. And so what that ultimately means, it's going to limit our ability to be thinking about large-scale, long-lasting impacts like sea level rise driven by climate change, hurricanes of increasing intensity, and other threats where we have to engage in predictions. You know, in the past, what the agency has done is it's used very reasonable predictions based both on past experiences and also what experts know about, you know, how climate is changing into the future. These new regulations would make it so that the agency has to reasonably determine what is likely in the future, not just with regard to the threats, but also with how the species will respond. And the idea of trying to determine with certainty or with likelihood what is going to happen really limits the ability of experts to make predictions. And it undercuts this idea of a precautionary principle or being extra cautious so that we don't you know, lose a treasure like the key deer or the Florida panther, the red-cockaded woodpecker, simply because we weren't thoughtful enough and we weren't thinking far enough into the future.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you do bring up that, or I read somewhere that example was brought up, I think it was by you somewhere, you know, about the key deer and some other, you know, endangered plants on the Florida Keys that could be destroyed by climate change. You know, now, I guess if you're of a mind to think that climate change is a hoax and the seas aren't going to rise, although evidence says that it is, you know, and you don't want to count that, then they're kind of out of luck, right? I mean, it's, you know,
that's right.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, most Floridians who've been here at least a little while would tell you that these things are happening, you know, between the sunny day flooding in Miami, the huge hurricanes that we saw the year before this past hurricane season. You know, we were fortunate not to get too hard in Florida this year, but, you know, I think most people you would ask would say, yes, we are already feeling those impacts, and we need to be not just preparing our human communities, but also preparing for where our animal communities are going to be able to survive in the future.
Yeah, because this goes down to some changes in another section of the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, right, about trying to predict critical habitat or protect critical habitat.
Right. So under Section 4 as well, protections for critical habitat. And what the statute says is that every species should be given protected critical habitat. These are areas that are essential for their survival and recovery, so long as it's prudent to do so and they can determine where that habitat is. And you're exactly right. These regulatory rollbacks would also make it, would allow these agencies to decide not to protect habitat that's at risk from large-scale threats like climate change. And it would also prioritize protecting currently existing occupied habitat over areas that are unoccupied. For species that are living on the coast in the Florida Keys or even along the peninsula, many places they're living now are likely to be underwater in the future. And so we really have to be thinking about places that maybe they're no longer living but could again. And so, again, this just goes back to sort of undercutting this common sense, prudent, and thoughtful approach to planning for the future.
Yeah, and doesn't this kind of thinking? I mean, this is maybe a little off the track, but I know there's always discussions, here in Florida about the Florida panther and how the Florida panther is endangered and that there's always, there has been some good legislation to provide crossing places for animals over highways and such, because that's the main way that they, get killed, but this kind of thinking makes it tougher for, government to do that kind of thing, right? I mean, it's they're putting that on the back burner, basically.
Yeah, it really ties the hands of the experts who should be the ones making the decisions about conservation for these species. We the people hire these scientific experts to work at these agencies specifically because of their knowledge and because they know how to get the job done right. And all of this just makes their work harder. And frankly, it also means, often with the species protection and recovery, the earlier you start the work, the easier it is to bring them back away from the brink of extinction and the less expensive it is. If you wait till you only have a handful of a creature left, you have to use incredible interventions just to keep them from blinking out. And it's well worth the money because biodiversity is important not only for those individual species, but for us. But frankly, it just doesn't make a lot of fiscal sense to wait until that point when we could be doing the work on the front end of recovering these species and then taking good care of them from the outset.
Yeah, just, out of curiosity, what are some species here in Florida that could be affected by this that are, if not already on the endangered list, could be soon?
Yeah, so it's important to point out that these regulations, in terms of listing and critical habitat protection, are forward-looking. So any species that has already been listed under the Act or that has already received critical habitat, likely will not be affected by those aspects of the rules. But there are many species who are currently in the process of waiting for protections, and that includes the ghost orchid, which has been proposed for endangered species protections, the mimic glass lizard, which is this lovely little legless lizard that lives up in the northern part of Florida. They're really beautiful, shiny lizards. They can dig underground. They live underground. We have beautiful flowers like the hidden blue pearls and the Hobay blue pearls. And the Miami cave crayfish, which lives in the Biscayne aquifer and depends on having healthy, clean water in the aquifer for its survival. All these species are awaiting some aspect of protection and could be impacted by these regulatory changes.
But there's also ones that we all know about, like the manatee. I mean, isn't
yes.
the manatee, kind of in danger?
Yes, the
manatee county.
Right. Yes, that's a great example of one that everybody knows and loves. And the manatee historically under the Act has been treated as one species in terms of its protection, but there's actually two subspecies. There's the Florida manatee and the Antillean manatee. And so just this past year, the Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to list each subspecies separately. So it proposed to list the Antillean manatee as endangered and the Florida manatee as threatened, which unfortunately is really not a great reflection of where these manatees are at, especially after that huge mortality event we had several years ago where we lost thousands of them because of poor water quality and the impacts on their food in the Indian River Lagoon. But nevertheless, they've been proposed for threatened species protections. And that means that until that rule is finalized, these regulations, if finalized before the manatees get their protection, could influence the level of protection for the manatees' habitat, as well as the protections for threatened species in general, because that's another change that has been proposed under these regulations. It's a proposal to eliminate what are known as blanket protections for threatened species. Under the Endangered Species Act itself, endangered species are automatically protected from being killed, harassed, chased, captured, harmed. Threatened species don't automatically get that protection under the Act, but by regulation, the Fish and Wildlife Service has extended those protections. And again, it's a common sense idea of, if they're at risk of becoming endangered, we should protect them strongly on the front end and work to recover them off the list. This regulatory proposal would remove those blanket protections and require a species-specific rule for every single threatened species that's listed moving forward. And so, often what those species-specific rules do is they provide loopholes and carve-outs for polluters and industry. And unfortunately, it also imposes a huge regulatory burden that simply doesn't need to exist. And that's especially troublesome given all of the havoc that DOGE has wreaked on our wildlife agencies. I mean, they have cut so many staff people from these agencies already. They've cut funding. So the idea that you have this skeleton crew working at the wildlife agencies and then you're giving them this huge burden of creating all these species-specific rules doesn't really make a whole lot of sense and is very likely to undermine really important protections for these species.
That's a great point. I want to interrupt just for a second. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Elise Bennett, who is the Florida and Caribbean Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Yeah, that is a great point about how those agencies seem to be doged as hard as any other important federal agency. And just in case people are wondering, I mean, we're talking an awful lot about preserving these endangered species. What's the science behind it? Why is it important to preserve diversity in our world, in our environment?
Yeah. Well, I think, it's pretty simple, and it's that, we live in an intertwined world of living beings that all depend on each other. We've got pollinators from bees to butterflies to bats, that pollinate wild plants, but also pollinate our crops, maybe our backyard gardens. Our coral reefs are the nurseries for our fisheries. They also act as buffers for storm surge, so they can protect our coast from great storms. But as you start to chip away at that biodiversity, you may not be able to point to any one species and say that species, if it disappears, is going to be, the end of everything for humanity. But we do know that if you let that fabric of life fray enough, eventually it can't support us anymore. And so I would say, there's a very selfish reason for us all to care about protecting biodiversity. And I think a lot of that is really at the heart of why Congress felt it was so important to pass this law back in the 1970s. which was signed into law by President Nixon, by the way. But I think, you know, beyond that, so many people also care about the inherent value of these creatures. Many of them have existed in one form or another long before we ever even walked the earth. You can see it when you look at alligator snapping turtles, you know, they almost look like dinosaurs. And it would be an awful shame for us to cause them to blink out of existence when they've already made it this far. So I think there's a lot of really sort of personal survival reasons for people to care, but also ethical. And, you know, so many people just love, you know, Florida panthers. They love Florida bonneted bats. You know, even the crayfish that I mentioned earlier that lives in the Biscayne Aquifer, it's bright pink. It's adorable, you know, and what a special world we live in that we get to share it with all of these creatures.
You know, and just to make a comment too about how it's hard to predict what the loss of any single species will mean. It's kind of like you don't know what you got till it's gone. You know, we won't find out if we lose some species just how important it really was to our own existence. So, you know, that is, I guess, a selfish reason to keep in the back of one's head about this. You know, changing the subject a little bit, you know, and I don't expect you to be an expert on this, but would appreciate just a little bit of comment. You know, the Trump administration wants to change the park pass by inserting the president's picture on it, as well as changing the days that citizens could get free entry, including the president's birthday. The center, I understand, is suing because it's in violation of the Federal Lands Recreation Enhancement Act that requires the secretaries of the Interior and Agriculture to hold an annual photography contest to determine which photo appears on the annual America is Beautiful Pass. You know, this year the winner was Glacier, I don't know, an image from Glacier National Park, not Trump's face. You know, how else is adding this president's picture a violation of the act? I mean, it's like, you know.
Yeah, well, I think you actually summarized the case really well. And I think part of the reason it's so important to us is because it's an affront to what Americans love and care about most. I mean, America's national parks were our country's best idea. And the idea that instead of featuring these enduring monuments to what a beautiful place we live in, we're featuring the visage of an egomaniac who's running our country is really disappointing. And I think it's frankly quite disgusting. And we've heard from many of our members about how upset they are about this. Not only is there just an aesthetic interest for people, but I think there's the educational value in being able to see pictures of these places and for those to be the emblems of our national parks rather than politicizing these passes.
Yeah, you know, and Trump is, you know, not exactly, you know, a rebirth of Teddy Roosevelt as far as the environment goes, as far as environmental law goes. Well, I'll tell you what, on that note, you know, I really want to thank you, Elise, Bennett, for making time for us today, and explaining a little bit about, you know, I don't know, what danger are endangered species, you know, maybe in these days. Please tell my listeners a little bit more about how they can learn more about this subject by going to the Center of Biological Diversity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to end this by saying hope should not be lost here. And I find hope every day in the millions of people who care about protecting biodiversity, not just here in our country, but across the world. And we are ready to fight and continue fighting for biodiversity. And we do that with our members. So for anybody who's interested in, being a part of the work to protect what makes Florida so special, they can visit our website, which is biologicaldiversity.org. You can sign up for emails, and there are opportunities to send comment letters to the agencies and to call our lawmakers, and to really focus on the biodiversity part. You know, there's so much going on, as you've talked about earlier, And we want to make sure that our nation's biodiversity isn't left in the background. And so, we welcome more members and more people receiving our emails, and it really makes a difference when people make those calls and send those letters.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Elise. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Right.
Suncoast Searchlight reports New College of Florida trustees were poised to vote this week on a tuition hike, raising questions about whether it would still qualify for a Trump administration agreement barring such increases for the next 5 years. The proposed 15% price hike for out-of-state students, which would go into effect in fall 2026, could complicate the college's plans to sign Trump's compact, which offers priority funding to schools willing to adopt a range of ideologically driven policies and implement a tuition freeze for American students. In response to questions from Suncoast Searchlight, a New College spokesperson said that the school remains first in line to sign the compact and suggests the outlet asked the White House whether it still qualifies. The White House did not return a request for comment. Since Governor Ron DeSantis overhauled the leadership of New College in 2023 and helped install former Republican House Speaker Richard Corcoran as president of the school, previously known for its progressive student body, has sought to remake itself into a conservative institution. New College has leaned into opportunities to bolster that image, publicly bringing on right-wing commentator Christopher Rufo as a trustee and hosting roundtable discussions with figures like Tom Homan, Trump's designated border czar. At an October 27th press release announcing New College's intention to sign the federal agreement, touted some of the changes that the school has made in recent years, including disbanding its diversity, equity, and inclusion programming and eliminating gender studies from the college's curriculum. The Trump administration initially offered the deal on October 1st to 9 selective universities, none of which have so far publicly agreed to sign on. Brown University, Dartmouth University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the Universities of Pennsylvania, Southern California, Virginia, and Arizona rejected the compact outright, which requires signatories to adopt a binary definition of gender and purge institutional units that punish, belittle, or even spark violence against conservative ideas. The compact purports to help colleges create an intellectually open campus environment with a broad spectrum of ideological viewpoints. But First Amendment groups, including Pen America, Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, have warned that the compact restricts academic freedoms and may be unlawful. Numerous universities and university associations, including the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, which represents more than 150 largely evangelical institutions, have objected to the compact, signing on to the October 17th statement that called the agreement nothing less than government control of a university's basic and necessary freedoms. The White House offered an initial deadline of November 21st for universities to sign on. In response to a question from New College Student Alliance President Kyla Baldonado during a December Board of Trustees meeting, Corcoran claimed that the proposed out-of-state tuition rate hike would not affect the compact because our in-state tuition has not been raised and has not been raised in over a decade. But the compact does not address in-state versus out-of-state tuition and instead specifies that signatories must commit to freezing the effective tuition rate charged to American students for the next 5 years. According to the college's most recent available fact book on enrollment, 18% of undergraduates enrolled in the fall 2024 were out-of-state, non-international students. You're listening to WSLR.